Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Keith Steinbaum, the president of the board for the World Affairs Council this year. I'd like to welcome you here today. I've taken the time on this beautiful day to come and be with us. And before we start into the other announcements, I do want to say I know a lot of us have family and or friends in Japan, and our thoughts are certainly with them as they're undergoing this terrible tragedy today. Please take a moment to turn off your cell phones so that we don't interrupt Professor Dunscombe while he's speaking. As you came in today, you notice there's a Great Harvest bread basket. Still a minute or so to get a ticket if you didn't get one when you came in. We also have two books for sale today. One is authored by Professor Dunscombe, our speaker today, and another is by an upcoming speaker, Victor Komras. So please check those out, and if you're interested, maybe some good reading. There's only a few more weeks to apply for your PFD, and while you're applying online, please consider making a donation to the Alaska World Affairs Council through the Pick, Click, Give program. This will be the third year of the program, and the process is getting easier each year. Just search for Alaska World Affairs Council in the list of organizations, and it allows you to give to Alaska's nonprofits. Please remember also that we are a membership organization. If you're not a member, please take a moment. We have the materials at the table at the entrance. Consider joining and supporting our programs. I know we have several students present. Would you stand, please, for a moment? I'd like to recognize our students. Thank you. And also, thanks to our sponsors, and especially BP, for the generous sponsorship of the meals for all the students, and also to ConocoPhillips for their sponsorship of the WorldCrest program for high school students. I'd also like to take a moment to thank William Toyer and Michael Cook, two of our board members who are recording today's program. We have a really good relationship with KSKA, and they have a portion of their website called AWAC Presents. Programs are available there for podcasts, and also certain programs are broadcast live or broadcast on KSKA. So if you're interested in listening to the program later or listening to other programs, you can check out their website. And as part of that, since we are recording this, when we get to the question portion, please wait for the microphone to come to you, and then you can ask your question, and that way it'll be audible for the people who are listening. Also like to thank today Claire Borsma. She kindly volunteered to come in and help Maya out today at the table, since both Lisa and Kari are out of town with spring break. And before I introduce the head table, I'd like to ask Claire to bring the basket up, and we'll have a drawing for the bread basket by our speaker. All right, number 583789. 583789. One of the students. Okay, and also at this time, I'd like to introduce our head table. Immediately to my left is our speaker, Professor Paul Dunscombe, and he'll be introduced in a moment. To his left is Professor Ted Kassir, who will be introducing him. And then on the end of the table is our Chuck Colson. Chuck is our newest board member, just appointed this last week. We welcome Chuck to work with us, and I'm glad you're here. Ted.
Thanks very much. Yet again, it is my pleasure to introduce my UAA colleague and fellow World Affairs Council board member, Dr. Paul Dunscombe, as a World Affairs Council luncheon speaker. Paul has been a full-time faculty member at UAA since 2001 and is currently tenured associate professor of East Asian history. He's been the director of the UAA Confucius Institute since before it began in December of 2008, and addressed us on prior occasions on a number of topics, including the Confucius Institute, but also several times on Japan. Paul is an East Asian scholar, having earned a PhD in that field from the University of Kansas. This isn't Kansas anymore, by the way, Paul. In 2001, and with numerous presentations and publications, both scholarly and popular. He was a visiting researcher at Tokyo University from September 1999 to August 2000, and prior to that had spent 1997 to 1998 at the Inter-University Center for Japanese Language Study in Yokohama, Japan. Among presentations on East Asian-related topics he has made in Alaska are The Crisis in Professional Baseball and the Future of Japan, Whatever Happened to Japan, the Economic Superpower That Never Was, China's Olympic Gamble and Other East Asian Spectator Sports, and The Crisis in North Korea, New Developments. Among the articles and essays he's published are Anime and Manga 101, A Primer for the Confused and the Curious, Dogs, Demons, and Die Guard, Preserving the Peace of Tokyo in 2030, and A Great Disobedience Against the People, Popular Press Criticism of Japan's Siberian Intervention, 1918 to 1922. So you can see that it is an interesting and rich mix of both popular culture and serious conventional scholarship that Professor Dunscombe brings to us. His book on Japan's Siberian Intervention, the first complete narrative on the topic, was released by Lexington Books just last month. Or did it escape like Godzilla? I don't know. As part of its New Studies of Modern Japan series, we do have copies for sale, and all proceeds will go to the World Affairs Council. So please buy a copy. Later this year, he has a book chapter coming out on the cultural topic of looking at Japanese-ness and the vision of Japan as portrayed in anime. Active, of course, not only in the research, development, and publication of knowledge in the field of East Asian studies, Dr. Dunscombe has also made other significant contributions in pedagogy. Serving as a group leader for a Freeman Foundation National Consortium for Teaching About Asia tour, Japan-Korea study tours in 2005 and 2008, and annually since 2003, he has been conducting Freeman Foundation National Consortium for Teaching About Asia seminars for local K through 12 teachers in both spring and fall. His teaching at UAA includes advanced courses on the rise, fall, and reinvention of the samurai and on communist China. Today's talk is the kickoff presentation of a book tour for the volume you have an opportunity to buy today, a tour that will take him, among other places, to Oxford and Cambridge, England, and to Hawaii. His topic with us today is Can Japan Be Changed? Lessons of the Forgotten Post-War. Please join me in welcoming him this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Ted, for that introduction. I especially appreciate the characterization of my research output as rich rather than perhaps eccentric. Certainly, I would also like to thank all of you for coming out today, especially the students that we have in our audience, since you are, after all, giving up part of your spring break to be with us today. So I thank you very much. Obviously, the events of yesterday in Japan puts Japan in our minds in a way that it might not have been before. I will give you my thoughts on that subject towards the end, since it requires me to somewhat significantly revise the ending of my paper. excuse me. I last spoke before you a bit over a year ago when I was pressed into emergency service to serve as the warm-up act for Senator Lisa Murkowski. Now, it says something about me, although I'm hesitate to say what, that my reaction to the experience of being dragooned to speak before you would be to request Lisa Fausco give me yet another opportunity to speak before you. But I do have certain incentives to speak before you today. As Ted mentioned, my book, Japan-Siberian Intervention, 1918-1922, A Great Disobedience Against the People, came out last month after a long and somewhat tortured birth. I've been working on this project in one form or another since about 1997. And while it is most certainly refreshing to see all that effort finally pay off, I will confess what pleases me most about having the book finally come out is the chance to at last lay the fruits of a decade of research before my fellow scholars and hopefully a somewhat wider public. This work represents the first ever complete narrative of Japan's 50-month adventure in Siberia in English, and indeed is the first particular book on this particular topic in over 50 years. It contributes meaningfully to our understanding of the development of Japanese imperialism in the interwar period and fleshes out the rather intimate relationship between the evolution of Japan's empire and its domestic politics. The period from August 1918, when the intervention began, to October of 1922, when it finally came to an end, encompasses a period of existential crisis for the Japanese, where it appeared that global trends in politics, society, and economics were undermining the basic paradigm of Japan as a modern state, while suggesting an alternative vision of modern nationhood that rejected empire acquired through conquest in favor of constitutional democratic politics at home and a more cooperative spirit in international affairs. All of this was caused by the playing out of the First World War and the immediate post-war period. The victory of the Allied and associated powers over German imperialism and autocracy, coupled with the collapse of empires in Germany, Austria-Hungary, Ottoman Turkey, and Tsarist Russia, appeared to offer an unarguable rejection of militarism, aggressive imperialism, and authoritarian government in favor of democratic, liberal constitutional governments at home, and subscribing to the tenets of Wilsonian internationalism as laid out in his famous 14 points. Most of you should find the scenario quite familiar because you've all been there before quite recently. Popular reaction to the new world situation occasioned by the trends of the times immediately following the First World War mirror the end of history which we experienced as the Cold War came to an end over the period from 1989 to 1992. Liberal free market democracies had once again triumphed in a contest against totalitarian authoritarian regimes, these communist in orientation. However, this post-war moment of triumph proved quite brief, and so it was with the post-war moment following the First World War. Just as we saw history resume with a vengeance on September 11th, 2001, within a decade and a half at most, the superiority of democratic constitutional politics, indeed the relevance of democracy to the problems of many nations worldwide, was challenged, and imperialist authoritarianism seemed poised to dominate world affairs. Examination of this fleeting, forgotten post-war period after World War I is useful from a number of standpoints. The first being that it can provide useful insights into why Japanese politics took the eventual orientation that it did towards authoritarianism and aggressive imperialism in the 1930s and 1940s. But more profoundly, the study of this period is useful because this represents the only other time in Japanese history where the Japanese were really able to debate and to shape their own destiny without outsized interference from from outside forces. Unlike the forced opening of Japan in the mid-19th century and its unprecedented transition to modernity, or the attempt to reorient Japan, which took place under American auspices during the occupation years following defeat in the Second World War, Japan in the period 1918 to 1922 was free to chart its own course. The Siberian intervention, therefore, can serve as a prism through which we can observe this debate over how Japan should accommodate itself to the trends of the times brought forth by the New World situation and the various alternative policies which Japanese contemplated to meet this challenge. Ultimately, what makes a World Affairs Council audience a most appropriate venue for a discussion of this topic is because these debates possess a quite eerie and almost unnerving set of contemporary resonances. Certainly, we Americans have come to appreciate the story of a military adventure of dubious advantage to the national interests, widely unpopular and seemingly endless, but which no amount of public disapproval seems able to end or indeed meaningfully modify. And certainly none of this was written with a potential Libyan intervention in mind, but if you find your thoughts wandering in that direction, I won't do anything to stop you. However, by far the most remarkable resonances, at least for me, can be found within Japan itself, as it has undergone a transformation over the last year and a half, almost as monumental as the one that took place with the inauguration of parliamentary party cabinets in 1918, which was in part caused by the intense public disapproval over the Siberian intervention. But before I get into that, some necessary preliminaries. Ever since I've been working on this project, whenever I've told people that I was writing a book about the Siberian intervention, the inevitable follow-up question has been, what's a Siberian intervention? I do not actually find this disheartening at all. If nothing else, it simply confirmed the necessity of my completing my research. However, it does suggest that I need to begin by answering this question, and this can be somewhat tricky since the question, while it seems comparatively simple, the origins and the course of the Siberian intervention were in fact quite complicated. Talk about sending Japanese forces into Siberia began almost from the moment that Lenin's Bolshevik government took power in November of 1917. The threat of the Bolsheviks to take Russia out of the First World War was viewed most seriously in Paris and Tokyo, and in both places it seemed that the dispatch of Japanese troops to Russia would be the most efficacious way to deal with the situation. But the objectives of the two sides were entirely different, and this made finding the basis for an intervention quite difficult. For the French and British, the primary objective of sending troops to Siberia was so they could pass through it on their way towards reconstituting an Eastern Front against Germany in European Russia. For the Japanese, the collapse of Russian central authority provided them with both opportunities and dangers. Many imperial activists within the government and the army general staff were eager to exploit the post-revolutionary chaos in the Russian Far East in much the same way as they had exploited the similar situation in China since 1912. Many Japanese also worried about the threat that an unstable Russia, or worse yet, one dominated by hostile Bolsheviks, could pose to Japan's colonial possessions in Korea and South Manchuria, as well as Japan's position in Manchuria generally. But there was also a significant segment of the Japanese population and popular opinion that distrusted the military and the government and feared that they wished to plunge the nation into a reckless and open-ended quest for advantages on the continent. This group was keenly impressed by the example of the Great War to suggest that Japan should abandon its traditional policy of securing empire through conquest as proof of Japanese modernity and national power, in favor of embracing the so-called trends of the times and pursuing the objects which had led Britain and most especially the United States into the front ranks of the great powers, namely democratic constitutional government at home and a spirit of cooperation rather than conquest in international affairs. Discussion of some form of intervention grew more urgent still after the Bolsheviks made a separate peace with Germany by the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in March 1918. Although France and Britain applied considerable pressure for an intervention, both Japan and the United States, for widely divergent reasons, were unwilling to send troops to Russia in order to reconstitute an Eastern Front against Germany. Even those within the Army General Staff and the government who were most eager to intervene stayed their hands, since they perceived the project as being wildly beyond Japan's means, and for fear of alienating the United States, which was unalterably opposed to any sort of intervention in Siberia. Debate surrounding an intervention, which took place in Japan throughout the spring and summer of 1918, was not merely a discussion of whether troops should be sent to quell disorders in Siberia. For many Japanese, the question of intervening in Siberia was tantamount to whether or not Japan should join the war against Germany as a full belligerent. Although Japan had entered the war in August of 1914, the costs so far, fewer than 100 million yen and just over 1,000 killed, were far outweighed by its benefits, including an economic boom and military control over the former German colonies in China and the Pacific north of the equator. However, involvement in Russia would not only require far more substantial numbers of troops and much greater expenditures, but risk plunging the empire into the same sort of war of attrition that its allies were trapped in. The constant discussion of Japan's duty as an ally, continuing reports in newspapers and magazines of the eastern spread of German power into Asia, and the publicly expressed attitude of the general staff that sending troops to Siberia essentially constituted invasion of a hostile nation, led to a feeling that Japan was on the verge of plunging forward into a vast and dangerous undertaking. And then came the Czechs. In May and June of 1918, Czechoslovak troops occupied key points along the Trans-Siberian Railway, leading to the overthrow of Bolshevik power throughout Siberia and creating the basis for building a white counter-revolutionary government that could contest with the Bolsheviks for control over Russia. If what's a Siberian intervention is the inevitable first question that people ask me when I speak of my book, the inevitable second question when trying to describe the intervention is, what's up with those Czechs? What were they even doing in Siberia in the first place? Once again, this is a question that I am quite happy to answer, although once again the answer is a complicated one. Long story short, the so-called Czech Legion had been formed primarily out of Austro-Hungarian POWs who agreed to fight for the Allies to secure independence for Czechoslovakia after the war. Marooned in Russia by the Bolshevik Revolution and subsequent Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, they were being sent in dribs and drabs along the Trans-Siberian Railway to Vladivostok for eventual transshipment to fight on the Western Front. Finding the Czechs largely immune to Bolshevik propaganda, fear of what they might do as they passed through the Russian Far East, where Bolshevik control was weak at best, caused the Bolsheviks to resist the movement of the Czechs. This finally led to a confrontation in late May 1918, which caused Czech troops to seize most of the Trans-Siberian Railway in an attempt to link up with their fellows still over 5,000 miles away in western Siberia. In so doing, the Czechs essentially became the spearhead of a counter-revolutionary white army invading Bolshevik Russia. The story of the Czech Legion, which became a global sensation, and the perceived need to rescue them from Bolshevik encirclement, caused U.S. opposition to a Siberian intervention to evaporate. In July 1918, President Woodrow Wilson proposed a joint dispatch of U.S. and Japanese troops to Vladivostok. Each nation would send a modest force of 7,000 men each to secure the vast amounts of Allied war materials stockpiled in and around the port and to establish a base for the rescue of Czechoslovak troops. Seizing their opportunity, the Japanese Army General Staff, despite the wishes of the United States, the Japanese cabinet, or the Japanese general public, in August of 1918 dispatched 72,000 men to seize the Transbaikal, Amur, and maritime provinces of the Russian Far East, taking control of the Trans-Siberian Railway from Vladivostok to Irkutsk and its subsidiary Chinese Eastern Railway running through North Manchuria. Meanwhile, just as the intervention was being announced and implemented, and partly in response to events in Siberia, Japan was rocked by the so-called Rice Riots of August and September of 1918. As a result of these protests, the government fell and was replaced by Japan's first cabinet, drawn from the majority party in the Diet, the Seiyukai Party, under the leadership of Hara Takashi. This epical event was welcomed by the Japanese people not only for the prospect of inaugurating so-called responsible government, that is, the domination of the cabinet by the majority party in the parliament, but because it was hoped that this new government, following popular opinion, would bring the unpopular Siberian intervention to an end. After World War I ended in November of 1918, the Hara cabinet was able to bring half of the troops in Siberia home, partly in response to the demands at home and partly in response to U.S. protests. And from that point, the overall objective of the Siberian intervention shifted from an ostensibly anti-German to a vaguely anti-Bolshevik emphasis. However, after the collapse of the White government at Omsk in late 1919, the United States announced its intention to withdraw, and the last U.S. troops left Vladivostok on April 1, 1920. The Japanese government was unable to follow suit, although many, both within and outside the government, argued for leaving with the United States. The Hara cabinet found itself unable to do so. This was partly because a standoff between the cabinet and the Army General Staff, which was intent to remain in Siberia, paralyzed decision making. But it was also in part caused by Hara's own fears for Japan's position in Korea and Manchuria should the Bolsheviks prevail. Moreover, from March through June of 1920, the slowly developing disaster of the Nikolaevsk massacre, which involved the slaughter of nearly 700 Japanese soldiers and civilians by Russian partisans turned freebooters, gave the government an indisputable excuse to remain in Siberia. The Hara cabinet's official statement of March 31, 1920, cited the need to protect the lives and property of its nationals as justification for Japanese troops to remain in the Russian Far East until the political situation there had been stabilized. During the second half of 1920, the Hara government was able to whittle down the size of the occupied territories and the number of troops stationed there, and in May of 1921, it was able to compel the General Staff to agree to a complete withdrawal from the maritime province in principle. However, a rump intervention centered on Vladivostok persisted while representatives of the army desperately attempted to gain a favorable position for Japan in the newly formed Far Eastern Republic, a non-communist buffer state which was formed in late 1920 on the orders of Lenin to assuage Japanese fears of a Red Army sweeping up to the shores of the Japan Sea. Although the Japanese government pursued negotiations with Soviet authorities, Japan's army in Siberia achieved neither the stability nor the commercial advantages that they had sought. And when a non-party cabinet headed by Admiral Kato Tomosaburo assumed power in June of 1922, he immediately announced that Japanese forces would leave Siberia by the end of October. When the last troops left on October 25th, 1922, virtually all of the Japanese civilians in Siberia left with them. In the end, the Siberian intervention cost the Japanese government somewhere on the order of 700 million yen, and that's at a time when the yen was about 3 to the dollar, and at least 2,000 lives. All or part of 11 of Japan's 21 divisions contributed troops to the intervention, which ultimately led to approximately 240,000 soldiers serving there during the course of the intervention. In exchange for all this effort, the Japanese government achieved nothing whatsoever. Japanese influence in the Russian Far East was entirely extinguished. Perhaps you can see why historians have not been terribly eager to take up the subject of the intervention, since it represents a failure of quite epic proportions, ultimately yielding Japan nothing. But the most profound cost of the intervention was to the faith that the Japanese people could place in the ability of responsible democratic cabinets to actually fulfill public desires. At the end of the intervention, the popular daily newspaper Osaka Mainichi complained, quote, "The story has already been told of the Terauchi cabinet's great mistake of secretly dispatching 10 times the number of troops that it told the U.S. it would to the occupied areas. But the Seiyu Kai cabinet, unable to overcome the opposition of a military clique run wild, must bear a large measure of responsibility. After the intervention, the shameful acting Terauchi and Hara cabinets both must bear responsibility for this crime," unquote. Yet the reputation of the military was equally damaged by the experience of the Siberian intervention, and it is not an accident that the end of the intervention marked the absolute nadir of the army's prestige in the interwar period. An Osaka Mainichi editorial denouncing the army's double diplomacy in Siberia proclaimed, quote, "Should the military's overgrasping power be maintained and the evil practice of double diplomacy not be changed, one must know that our Japanese empire can be unexpectedly plunged into chaos. With this incident, we must ring the death knell of the militarists. However, in order to do this, we must speedily move in the direction of universal suffrage. Let that be our consolation for this incident," unquote. In the end, the Japanese public was left with a plague on both your houses attitude, nicely expressed by the editorial board of the Osaka Mainichi. Quote, "The failure of our Siberian intervention teaches us an expensive lesson, that our politicians are short-sighted and irresolute, that our nation can sustain unnecessary loss from the militarists' mistaken aggression. At the same time, we see that the voice of the people has become very weak. For all the people's opposition to stationing troops in Siberia, it has bought them nothing. No greater example than this can be found of our government and military stubbornly resisting public opinion," unquote. Now, that's where the story that I tell in my book ends, but the punchline is that party politicians and the Imperial Army both faced the task of regaining public trust and convincing the Japanese people that they could fulfill the expectations placed in them. For political party cabinets, it was necessary to demonstrate that they could achieve public desires to enact universal manhood suffrage and deal with the economic difficulties of the urban and rural poor. While universal suffrage legislation was finally passed in 1925, which made all males aged 25 and older eligible to vote, mishandling of the economy and the perceived inability to maintain Japan's position in China as it was being unified under Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government helped further undermine public confidence in democratic politics. Meanwhile, for the army, the lesson they chose to take from the disastrous intervention in Siberia was not that the mission itself was essentially futile or that the Imperial Army was constitutionally unfitted to carry it out. Rather, being sympathetic to Imperial Germany, They prefer to subscribe to a miniature stab-in-the-back theory, that lack of support from Japanese on the home front undercut the Army's morale and made it impossible to push the mission forward to a successful conclusion. The subsequent task of the Army, therefore, was, in league with Japan's ardent imperialists, to once again convince the Japanese people of the importance of seeking empire as the necessary proof of modernity, national power, and indeed national survival, and of the centrality of the Army in securing such an empire. So party politicians ultimately failed in their quest, while the military, through rampant insubordination, flouting the rules imposed by Japan's constitutional system, along with assassination of civilian politicians, were able to cement themselves as the dominant force in Japanese politics with the widespread approval of the general public. The journalist Robert Kaplan, commenting rather dourly on the swift passing of our own post-Cold War democratic moment, noted that, quote, democracies do not always make societies more civil, but they do always mercilessly expose the health of the societies in which they operate, unquote. Examining Japanese societies that passed through the post-World War I democratic moment, we can see that it possessed a mix of healthy and unhealthy elements. Certainly in terms of its public sphere and the vigor of public debate about what needed to be done to accommodate the nation to the world situation, or simply to ride out the trends of the times, it is not going too far to say that Japanese society was never healthier in the pre-war period. But the limits of this debate were always strictly demarcated, and their relative width during this period was primarily the responsibility of indulgent censors. The rise of the Hara cabinet did bring Japanese society substantially closer to creating an indigenous functioning democracy, but its operation also laid bare the insuperable obstacles in the way of making responsible cabinets true masters of the Meiji political system and the ultimate arbiters of policy. The use of violent public opinion against the military for undermining the cabinet and threatening Japan's international status, did help strengthen parliamentary forces, but frustration with the failures of the Hara cabinet to deliver the public's desires revealed the general lack of people truly committed to the democratic process. Meanwhile, military obstreperousness and outright insubordination revealed attitudes towards constituted authority which were profoundly dangerous for the continued functioning of the Meiji political system. Therefore, it becomes very difficult to view this period in Japanese history as a missed opportunity to radically alter the course of its national development or deflect it from the road which ultimately led to Pearl Harbor, war with the United States and Great Britain, and defeat. In the end, then, it was never likely that the new paradigm of Japan as a modern state could have established itself in the brief window of opportunity afforded to it in the immediate post-war period, and such an outcome became increasingly unlikely as the 20s and 30s wore on. As we know, pursuit of empire as the necessary proof of Japanese modernity ultimately led the Japanese to the disaster of war and defeat. Afterwards, as you heard me explain back in May of 2009, a new consensus was established which sought economic power as the ultimate proof of Japanese modernity. However, pursuit of that paradigm also proved problematic as the collapse of the bubble economy in 1989, coupled with the rapidly changing international environment surrounding Japan with the end of the Cold War, caused the post-war consensus to undergo a long, agonizing death spasm, which we refer to as the lost decade. Presently, Japan finds itself in another window of potential change, and just like in 1918-1922, whichever way Japan ends up reorienting itself, or not, it will be almost entirely up to the Japanese themselves to decide. This became possible because in September of 2009, 91 years almost to the day that Hara Takashi became the leader of Japan's first political party cabinet, Hatoyama Yukio became prime minister of the first popularly elected cabinet not drawn from the Liberal Democratic Party in 61 years. It is true that the LDP had previously lost control of the government for a brief 11-month window in 1993-94, but this was a result of shuffling of the parties within the parliament. The overthrow of the LDP by the Democratic Party of Japan, the DPJ, in the lower house election of September 2009 was the first electoral defeat for the LDP since 1948. This was an outcome that appeared highly likely when I spoke to you about Japan in May of 2009, but there were still no guarantees that it might actually come off. However, the scale of the defeat of the LDP in September 2009 was simply unprecedented. Now, I noted elsewhere in the fall of 2009 that the victory of the DPJ opened up possibilities for the Japanese to reinvent themselves, which had not been as wide-ranging since the U.S. occupation of Japan following World War II. And it used to be quite typical of historians to view the occupation period in Japan as representing a reinvention of the nation and its society and a clean break with its past. Nowadays, however, we have a tendency to decry the might-have-beens of the occupation, opportunities for change which were not taken, and chances to empower the Japanese people which did not take place. We focus on continuities, including domination of the political system by big business, government bureaucrats, and the bureaucratic politicians of the LDP. Exactly what historians will make of the current post-LDP moment is hard to say, but we are now 18 months into it, and I would say that the dominant theme so far has not been change, but a reinforcement of trends already in place, and it appears that continuity will be the major story. That is, just as it was during the period following World War I, it is likely to prove very difficult to bring a fundamental reorientation of Japanese politics and society, particularly if it's in a direction which the Japanese people themselves fundamentally do not wish to go. One could, in fact, see the election victory of the DPJ as a manifestation of this. In many respects, the DPJ were able to portray themselves as agents of change, but also restorers of the status quo. Under the leadership of Koizumi Junichiro from 2001 to 2006, the LDP had pursued economic reforms which succeeded in ending the stagnation of the lost decade, but also ushered in a period where Japanese could perceive that the new economy would feature winners and losers, and entirely too many Japanese perceive themselves as losers. To restore the democratic egalitarian ethos that had been a major component of the old post-war consensus became a major plank of the DPJ's campaign. Once the DPJ secured its election victory, one of the areas where the government of Hatoyama Yukio sought to fundamentally alter Japan's basic orientation was in its relationship with the United States. The idea was that Japan would move out from under the shadow of the United States and engage in a more cooperative relationship with China. In particular, the discussion over U.S. bases in Okinawa was a major initiative of the DPJ in its early days. The Hatoyama cabinet had said it sought a renegotiation of the basic agreement to relocate a Marine Air Base there. This was stonewalled by the United States, and the necessity of admitting defeat on this issue led ultimately to Hatoyama's resignation and his succession by Kan Naoto, the current prime minister. Under Kan's leadership, any notion of removing Japan from the orbit of the United States has come to a definitive end. This is not entirely Kan's or even America's doing, since the Chinese themselves have helped this process along by their militant attitude towards disputed island territories in the South China Sea and saber-rattling and economic pressure following a confrontation between a Chinese fishing boat and Japanese Coast Guard vessels last September. Indeed, it was a direct result of this experience that caused the Kan cabinet to announce a fundamental reorientation of Japan's defense posture last December, which finally abandoned the old mission of halting a Soviet invasion of the North towards defense of Japan's maritime frontier to the south. Ironically, this is likely to mean that if there is a reduction of the U.S. presence on Okinawa, it is likely to be immediately replaced by Japanese self-defense forces, so there will be no diminution of the military footprint on Okinawa. Simultaneous to this, as a result of the North Korean shelling of South Korean islands, Japan, with the encouragement of the United States, entered discussions with South Korea over how Japanese forces might cooperate with U.S. and South Korea in the event of renewed hostilities on the Korean Peninsula. This was simply an unprecedented development, although one that was accompanied by more than a little squeamishness in both Japan and South Korea. But perhaps nowhere have the limits of change been better outlined than in the fate of the man most associated with the victory of the DPJ in September of 2009, Ozawa Ichiro. And Ozawa's story is the one that most merits comparison to Japan in the post-World War I era. There is no figure in Japanese politics in the post-war period who serves as a better analog to Hara Takashi than Ozawa. However, the similarities and differences between Hara and Ozawa are quite revealing. From his election to the lower house of parliament in 1902, Hara Takashi worked tirelessly to make his party, the Seiyu Kai, an ancestor of the LDP, the dominant force in Japanese politics. He did this in part through a dedication to pork barrel politics and a willingness to compromise with the oligarchic politicians, bureaucrats, and even the military, which dominated Japanese politics. His continuous resort to compromise, combined with his genuine distrust of mass democratic politics, kept him from achieving true popular acclaim within his lifetime, and even now, historians tend to view him rather coldly. Since he bolted from the LDP in 1991, Ozawa Ichiro worked tirelessly to make himself prime minister. And in so doing, he has undergone a series of political transformations. To give just one example, by March of 2000, Ozawa had become leader of the so-called Liberal Party, which contributed its 12 seats in the parliament to the coalition government of Keizo Obuchi. However, at the end of March 2000, Ozawa's led half of his party out of the coalition, inaugurating a crisis which may ultimately have led to Obuchi's subsequent stroke and replacement. And outside the government now, Ozawa formed a new opposition party named the Conservative Party, which goes well to show you about truth of advertising in Japanese politics. Over the course of the last decade, Ozawa's conservatives, along with a number of other smaller parties, agreed to be absorbed by the DPJ as part of the process whereby it finally cemented itself as the major opposition party to the LDP. And Ozawa himself eventually climbed to become the leader of the DPJ and was widely perceived as the mastermind behind its rise to a position where it could topple the LDP. By 2009, he was the presumptive prime minister of a new DPJ government. However, in March of that year, just as the prize he had worked 2 decades to achieve appeared to be in his grasp, he was forced to resign as president of the DPJ due to a campaign finance scandal. Even so, he retained a position within the senior leadership of the DPJ and was widely perceived as the eminence grise of the party. Then in the fall of last year, Ozawa made his last-ditch bid to achieve the prize that he had long sought. He challenged Kan Naoto as leader of the DPJ, running against him as president of the party. Had he succeeded, he would have become prime minister. This was a prospect which generated considerable unease, both within the party and among the general public. This was primarily because of the perception that he continued to wish to drive Japan towards a more basic reorientation with China, not to mention an association of Ozawa with all of the backroom deal-making and money politics of the old regime. In the end, he failed and has subsequently essentially been drummed out of the party by Kan. Meanwhile, the perceived ineffective and reactive nature of Prime Minister Kan's leadership has caused his popularity to fall to the 20% range, which has spelled the doom of every Japanese prime minister since Koizumi left office in 2006, which would be 4 if you're scoring at home. This is where I basically have to throw out my proposed ending and improvise a new one due to the events of the last 15 hours or so. I wasn't really going to dwell on the travails of the Kan cabinet or run through the litany of problems that it has suffered or challenges that it faces, since that list is actually quite long and somewhat depressing. However, the events of yesterday have really simplified things quite significantly. Basically, history doesn't matter. It's how they respond to this disaster which will shape the destiny of the DPJ in general and the Kan government in particular. If their response to the crisis is perceived as being swift and competent, they will succeed. And if it is perceived as being slow and fumbling, no power in the universe can save them. Ironically, here too, we have historical resonances, since the road back for rehabilitation of the Imperial Army in the eyes of the Japanese public was their perceived response to the great Kanto earthquake of 1923. And certainly the example of the Hanshin earthquake in 1995 is important as well. One of the things that was most important about the response to the Hanshin earthquake was the perceived ineffectiveness of the Japanese government, the Japanese self-defense forces, and indeed the Japanese political system generally to the plight of the survivors. And one should remember that the vast majority of the 6,000 people who died as a result of the Hanshin earthquake did not perish in the earthquake itself, but in the subsequent fires afterward, which the government seemed entirely incapable of dealing with. So it will be the immediate aftermath of this crisis which will ultimately seal the fate of Naoto Kan's cabinet and the DPJ in general. If they can succeed in dealing with this question, they will survive. In particular, they are likely to survive the upcoming upper house elections, which will happen this summer. If not, there is nothing that can save them. The question is, what alternatives are out there to the DPJ at this time? The LDP in opposition has become rather rudderless and fractured, and they are unlikely to become a really viable alternative to the DPJ anytime soon. The bureaucracy, which for many years in the post-war period truly dominated the political system in Japan, has also suffered its own crisis of faith and has become rather ineffective over the course of the last decade. So it is not necessarily ready to step in either. So exactly what's likely to happen is difficult to say, but it all depends on exactly how the government responds to this crisis. So I shall continue to watch, and I thank you very much for your attention. I'll be happy to take questions. Please wait for the microphone to get to you.
During the 1918 intervention, do you know what Japan did with regard to entry into Sakhalin Island, the part of Siberia that's closest to them and potentially most valuable since it's just loaded with natural resources?
Yeah, at the time, Japan actually controlled the southern portion of Sakhalin Island, and in response to the Nikolaevsk massacre, they sent in troops and occupied the northern portion of Sakhalin and basically held that for ransom until a Russian government could come along that could provide adequate redress for the events at Nikolaevsk. And ultimately what ends up happening in 1925 is that the Japanese restore the northern portion of Sakhalin to the Soviet Union as part of an overall deal for recognition of the Soviet government. However, they do so by retaining some rights concessions to oil development up in that region. Brian?
Thank you for revealing a piece of history I had no idea existed.
If we do it right, that's the way it's supposed to go.
And here I reveal my total ignorance of the situation. Was there an emperor at this time of the Siberian intervention? And did that enter into this at all?
What's particularly interesting about this period, which is often referred to as the Taisho Democracy Movement, Taisho was the reign name of the emperor who reigned 1912 to 1926. Unlike his father, the Meiji Emperor, or his son, Emperor Hirohito, the Showa Emperor, he had never been well. He suffered a number of diseases, was somewhat mentally unstable, and so very quickly after his reign began, he was essentially closeted in the imperial palace, and indeed his son Hirohito had to take over for him as prince regent in late 1921. And so the emperor was not really available to play that vital symbolic role that his father, the Meiji Emperor, and his son, the Showa Emperor, both played. And freed from the shadow of the emperor, Japanese politics had an opportunity to evolve in the teens in ways that neither the oligarchic power holders or upholders of the mystical notion of the emperor as the divine head of a semi-divine state quite approved of. So the closeting of the Taisho emperor was in fact a very important component in the evolution of Taisho democracy in many respects.
So. Thank you. I'm a student of history, and I didn't know any of that either. So, coming to the present, one of the things that we always hear is the aging Japanese population and a perceived unwillingness to allow emigrants in to do various jobs. How do you see the future of Japan given those two issues?
Robots. And I mean that only semi-facetiously. In fact, I was in Beijing back December. I happened to have lunch with a, she was the, not the chancellor, but a high official of the University of Pisa in Italy, and was an expert on robotics and had been studying in Japan. And one of the solutions that the Japanese government has poured an amazing amount of resources into is the development of functioning human-style robots who can assist with elder care. And are putting their efforts in to do this because by having, you know, these machines available, they do not have to open the country to emigration. In other respects, in terms of, for instance, allowing women to more productively operate in the workforce, the Japanese government has traditionally preferred to do things that would allow Japanese women to basically resume their lifestyle as traditional Japanese women rather than facilitating their participation in the workforce. That had changed somewhat under the DPJ, but had not changed unalterably. And indeed, the DPJ is likely to be as dedicated to robots as their predecessors in the LDP.
So. Well, jumping back from robots to history, when the Japanese pulled back after the end of the intervention, did the military or the Japanese generally sort of then have a grudge that then played out into the ongoing border battles between the Russians and the Japanese in the 30s? Was there a link between that, those events?
In many respects, no. That is, the Japanese army always perceived the Russian-Soviet military as its number one potential enemy, although by the end of 1922, they had to acknowledge the fact that the Russian army had fallen to such a state that, you know, you did actually have to kind of admit, they hated to do this, but they did actually have to admit that the Navy might be right, that the United States Navy actually presented the most, the greatest potential threat at that time. But they never really accepted that. So the Japanese military continued to view the Soviet military as its most dangerous potential enemy, and indeed it's that basic orientation which leads to the military confrontations that take place in the late 1930s, most famously the Nomonhan incident in the summer of 1939, where the Japanese army is in fact thoroughly defeated in a confrontation with the Soviet Union, which makes them decide that perhaps the time is not ripe to take on the Soviet military threat in the Russian Far East, which helps, once again, orient them towards the southern advance, which the Navy favors in 1940 and 1941.
What was the reason for the Manchurian invasion in, I believe, 1928?
The Manchurian incident itself takes place in September of 1931, although an important precursor event takes place in 1928 when the warlord in Manchuria that the Japanese had been cultivating since 1921, Chong Zolin, was assassinated by insubordinate military officers. And indeed, it was the army's outright refusal in the face of direct imperial order to prosecute these people that really kind of gave way to the wave of widespread military insubordination that ultimately proved the death knell for civilian democratic politics in Japan. But in many respects, although it came somewhat gradually, certainly by the early 1920s, the idea of Manchuria as representing Japan's lifeline, that is, the possession of Manchuria and some other bit of territory around it, either perhaps northward into Siberia or southward into central China, was absolutely fundamental for Japan's survival, had become basically an article of faith, certainly within the military. And one of the things that both the army and Japan's ardent imperialists are able to do throughout the 1920s is to convince through public campaigns and discussion that in fact this was the case. That is, by the time you get to 1931, there's no one in Japan, certainly as reflected in the newspapers, who seriously questions the notion that possession of Manchuria is absolutely vital for the survival of Japan as a modern industrial state, because among other things, Manchuria has the resources which Japan absolutely needs to prepare itself for the ultimate showdown with the Anglo-American powers.
Talking about, about the current policies, do you see the surge of foreign policy recently, maybe as an instrument for the Hatoyama and Kan's cabinet to kind of turn people away from the domestic problems?
In many, the basic idea was the sort of buildup of issues with China, basic reorientation of Japan's defense policy, whether these are in a way designed to sort of deflect public opinion from the failure of their domestic policies. If that was the plan, that has quite spectacularly failed. However, once again, with the immediate crisis in response to this disaster, an opportunity has been presented to the cabinet of Naoto Kan. If they can handle this situation competently, or be at least perceived as handling this situation effectively, then in many respects, all that has gone in the past will be forgiven. However, if not, heaven help them, because there is already a great deal of disenchantment with the performance of the DPJ, and they were certainly looking to have a rather thumping defeat in upper house elections this summer. And if they're not perceived as responding effectively to this crisis, the extent of which, by the way, we still don't understand. That is, we have some initial reports. We know certainly that there are going to be deaths in the hundreds, if not the thousands, property damage in the billions. So we know it's severe, but we still don't really have a true handle on the extent of the crisis. So if it proves possible for some semblance of normal life to resume in places like Tokyo and Yokohama, you know, places that were affected by the earthquake but not necessarily the tsunami, if some semblance of normal life can resume within a week, 2 weeks, or something like that, then I think that will bode well for the Kan cabinet. If not, there's likely to be a great deal of trouble. So, question over here.
Last night, while they were trying to scratch around for something to report on, there was an indication, I guess it was the Prime Minister, but I'm not sure, of the government, was saying that they were receiving indications of support and help from governments around the world. And what surprised me was that he said, and we welcome all of these and we will be taking advantage of them. My question to you is, does such an immediate acceptance of outside support bode as a positive for the current government, or does that look like a negative for the current government?
I think actually that bodes well. I think that's a direct lesson taken from the experience of the Hanshin earthquake in 1995, when there tended to be somewhat standoffishness amongst the Japanese, saying, you know, we are prepared for this notion, we can handle it, and then they were manifestly proved not ready to handle this. So I think it's reflective of, a realization that one does not want to say, you know, we can handle anything and then appear not to, but I think also it's an acknowledgement of the sheer scale of the disaster. This is the largest earthquake that Japan has perhaps ever experienced, as long as these things have been recorded. Once again, the damage will dwarf the Hanshin earthquake and the potential casualties as well. One of the things that I have noted in seeing the various bits of video that come back again and again is what I have not seen, which one definitely saw in 1995, are footage of infrastructure like elevated highways or bridges being down or destroyed. They're closed, but they're closed because they want to inspect them before they let people go back on them. But there's no obvious signs of failure in terms of the infrastructure. And indeed, one of the things that the Japanese government has been doing assiduously since 1995 has been essentially hardening already quite hardened systems for a shock of this magnitude. So in that respect, the Japanese response, which obviously is a long-term one, appears to have been quite quite effective. One last question. Brian?
Got another shot. you sort of mentioned two phases. One where there was a vision that the way you demonstrated your nationhood was by military conquest and expansion. Mm-hmm. The second by economic domination. What do you see where they may be going now?
Well, that's been the most interesting aspect of this. One has a very broad-based public consensus that, first of all, Japan must be modern, and it must be modern by featuring the things which the most modern nations of the day possess. So in the late 19th century, that's overseas empires, and that quickly becomes cemented in the public mind, except for this brief window in 1918, 1922, as the ultimate proof of Japanese modernity and national power. Clearly, in 1945, that vision is proved wanting. And what's quite remarkable is that bureaucrats within economic ministries, especially, who kind of ride out the purges very well, are, you know, even in the ashes of Tokyo in late 1945, were thinking, ah, you know, clearly the United States had economic power, so that's how we must go. And certainly by 1960, that consensus is once again in place that, all right, we must be modern in the same way that the leading nations of the day. That's clearly economic power. The United States has economic power. We want to have that too. And an unwillingness to give that up, really, is what I would argue prolonged the agony of the so-called lost decade, the first two decades of the current imperial reign in Japan, the early Heisei period. And what has made it very difficult for a new consensus to form has been, first of all, that the international environment that Japan inhabits, which was very stable, obviously, from 1945 to 1989, has been evolving kaleidoscopically, and the Japanese have been having a really tough time catching up, but also a failure, really, to posit a vision. Alternative visions have been offered. For instance, Koizumi's so-called normal country, Japan, but have been rejected. And the way I was kind of going to wrap up before the events of yesterday was to note that in many respects, it's possible that the Japanese people themselves have already kind of fixed on a new consensus. That is, Japan should just be an ordinary country. Not normal, but ordinary, and indeed might be quite content with that, because one of the benefits of executive board membership, I can tell you, is one gets privileged access to our speakers from time to time. So if you're contemplating running for the executive board, by all means, see Keith, our president. But I was having dinner with T.R. Reid when he was here early in February, and one of the things that we kind of commiserated on was the fact that we had both recently traveled to Japan, and we were struck by just how boringly normal it was and how much the Japanese people just seemed to be getting on with their lives and not really feeling a sense of gloom or despair, and in fact seemed to be enjoying things. And perhaps they have cottoned to something that the rest of us, and perhaps even Japan's political leadership, has not quite seen, that perhaps it's not necessary to be as modern or as advanced as the leading nations of the day. Perhaps it's just satisfactory to be a modern, advanced state, to be ordinary. There is actually, in many respects, nothing I could wish more for Japan than it has the opportunity to be ordinary. Okay. So, thank you.
Thanks very much, Paul. And you know, it's a tradition, we present a gift to our speakers after they speak, and normally, since it's people from outside, it's a memento of Alaska, but I don't think you need a